everybody. Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com. It's Wednesday, June the 8th, 2011. This is, what is this, our eighth podcast, I believe?
Something like that. Wow, really? 8 weeks?
Yeah, we're losing track already, and it's only eight. I think it's eight. I think we did seven last week. I think this is eight. If it's not, we'll just go back in and edit this and make it say, this is podcast, well, whatever it is. I'm pretty sure it's seven. Eight.
Well, it doesn't matter.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Kai.
Thanks for coming back and listening to us again. I wanted to mention one thing. We had a special podcast. It was an interview with a gentleman that we called Jim that was very interesting. If you didn't get to hear that, you should look back through the archives and find that. Jim has a lot of experience in life that's outside of the normal realm, not exactly what your average person on the street experiences, and I think you'll enjoy that episode if you haven't caught it. It's called Bad Quaker Interview Podcast Interview Episode 1 or something like that. Anyway, look on badquaker.com and poke around and you'll see it there. Just hit the All Podcast button on the right-hand side, and it'll bring up all the podcasts, and you can find whichever one you're looking for there. But Jim was a very interesting person to talk to. I'm trying to line up several other interviews with some also extremely interesting individuals. Another person in the private security sector, an active duty Army major, and possibly one other that I need to be contacting and see if we can line those things up. If you have any questions for any of these upcoming interviews, please send them to me at ben@badquaker.com. Any questions or comments about the podcast or about the website, you can send to badquaker@badquaker.com. That's the admin's address. And what else? Well, you were reading something interesting on Crack?
Yes, crack.com, which they should just call it crack.com because, you know, you get lost in there for hours and hours and hours. As it turns out, they've done a study. I forget who it was now. did a study where... I guess you could call it a study. I really want to have a job where I'm given massive amounts of money to play pranks on people. But they took these diners and they gave them bowls of soup. And some of them were just bowls of soup and, you know, they measured how much they ate with just the bowl of soup. And then some of them, they attached
filler,
like pumps to the bottom of the bowl of soup, and it kept filling the bowl of soup, so it was a never-ending bowl of soup. And they said that some of the people with the never-ending bowls would eat up to a quart of soup, because they had no
trigger to tell them that the bowl wasn't empty, so there was no trigger to tell them they were full.
Yeah, they had no, you know, spatial idea of how much soup that they had consumed.
Quart of soup. Yeah.
So, you know, it just goes to tell you that your brain can't tell how much you've eaten and your stomach is too stupid to tell your brain.
I was thinking of some days gone by, and I thought it might be interesting if we would talk about black markets a little bit. And specifically, I thought maybe I'd talk about some of my experiences with black markets. It's been some time. We're talking about late 70s, bleed into the 80s a little bit, but mostly the 70s. And I was very young at the time. I hung around Southern California. There were a lot of, a lot of bikers, a lot of activity on the beach with both with tourists and with surfers and with just people hanging out on the beach and so forth. And I got acquainted really well with a variety of types of black markets. And so I thought I'd just touch on those a little bit. One interesting aspect of black markets is the loan process in a black market. In some segments of society, there are people who don't have a credit card, who can't get a credit card, who have no access to these things. And especially back in the 70s, you didn't have these prepaid cards. So there was a lot of aspect of life that were cut away from you that you just couldn't be involved in,
right,
because you didn't have a credit card. So also, not everyone could afford insurance, you know, and not everyone could afford like a AAA towing and things like that. So if you were in this segment of the population that was somewhat outcast anyway, black market in loans was really your friend. We think of, you know, there's negative connotations, there's name calling and so forth, and we say, oh, well, that guy's a loan shark, or, you know, there's a whole field of terminology that's intended to scare people away and make them think that these people are evil. But really, people just make choices, and they make choices based on the situation they're in and based on what they feel to be their best options that they have available.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody sits in a, you know, $250,000 house watching their big screen TV or their plasma TV or whatever, and they see a Hollywood depiction of some shady character who's, you know, running numbers or running a loan shark outfit or whatever, we get these opinions formed for us and we just accept them.
And it's funny because most of the time, you know, you hear people and they say, oh, you know, you watch the movies and people are running numbers or they're doing any of these things, and people are like, oh, that's bad, he's a shady person. But they don't actually know what that is,
right?
Because they'll say that, they'll use those phrases in Hollywood movies, but they never actually go into detail about what is actually taking place.
Right. A numbers racket is basically a lottery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not basic. It is a lottery. There's no difference. There's absolutely no difference. A numbers racket is simply a lottery that is not run by the state.
Right.
And so one has to ask oneself, if a lottery is run by a guy named Bob, or if a lottery is run by a governor named Bob, what's the difference?
Right.
Well, you say, oh, well, you don't know that guy might cheat people. No, he won't.
Right.
The governor is a whole lot more likely to cheat you than that guy, because that guy's out in a world where there's nothing to protect him.
Yep.
The governor has literally an army to protect him. So the guy on the street who's running a numbers racket, first off, has to provide better odds than the state, because he's competing with the state.
Right.
Second off, he has to be honest. There has to be people in that neighborhood that are winning in the numbers racket in order for it to continue. If he's not paying, then, or if he shorts people or does anything that's shady in any way, or anything that's not above board, it can cost him anything from his business to his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so typically, a numbers racket is extremely clean.
Right.
And here's the other thing. There's no victim. There's absolutely no victim in a numbers racket. It entirely supports itself, and it pays the players. And it hurts nobody, because nobody's forced to be involved.
And there's no lies. You know,
yeah.
you hear the lottery, they'll say, oh, play the lottery, all the proceeds go to the schools.
Yeah.
But that's just a lie. I mean, that's not even a good lie. It's just a lie. And there's none of that in the racket, you know.
Right.
In the numbers racket, they don't say, oh, well, we give it to charity. No, it's a business.
Right.
It goes to you. It's your profit.
Right. And that's something, too, that people really forget. Before the lottery swept the nation in the 80s and 90s, they were sold to the public as being the solution of all the woes and all the problems of funding for the massive, bloated, fat, greasy schools that we have. Lotteries...
Socialist. You forgot socialist.
Socialist. They are socialist schools. Lotteries were sold to the public as being the solution to that. And yet, not one problem that existed prior to the lotteries was solved. And here we are, all these years later, and every single problem is still there because the lottery is not a solution to the problem.
Right.
The problem is the massive socialist schools.
Right. The problem isn't that there isn't enough money.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is who is in charge of the money.
And that it's a centrally planned thing instead of a free market thing.
Right.
And centrally planned always produces a lower quality and shortages. And we're on a side note, we're watching the cat freak out over here. She's got a hold of some catnip, so we're going to be distracted for a second here. But in addition to running numbers and a numbers racket, there are also things that are portrayed in movies in Hollywood as being horribly evil, and yet they're not. They're really a service for people who don't fit into society in other ways. Loan sharking is a fantastic example. I was talking to a friend once on this topic, and I gave him a scenario, and it's actually based on real life, but I don't want to put names and get too specific. But when I was in this life style that I'm talking about, this was, like I said, late 70s, and there were a lot of bikers that were doing this, financing their lifestyle through loan sharking. Now, and you think, oh, well, that's drug dealing, or that's thuggery, where they beat people up. No. I mean, there are lots of drug dealers, and there are bikers who are drug dealers. But loan sharking is strictly a business, mm-hmm. and it can or it doesn't have to have anything at all to do with drugs. And the example I gave to this person, I was talking to him, let's say you have a guy, and he lives in Barstow, California. And for some reason, he has to drive down into the L.A. Basin. Now, his car, you know, he works, he has a job, he's a legitimate guy, he has a job, he doesn't have the best job, he doesn't have the best education, he's doing as good as he can, he's trying to support his family, but he doesn't have a lot of money. So his car is not the greatest thing in the world, but he has to go to L.A. So he gets in his car, and he makes the trip. He gets down in the heart of L.A., and the stupid car breaks down on him. Now, what's he going to do? Within the realm of society, what's going to happen is, if he can't get his car off the freeway within a specific time frame, a city wrecker, it's not owned by the city, but it's contracted to the city, that's called fascism. A city wrecker will whip down the freeway, spot him, call it in, get authorization, and haul his car, whether he wants it or not, haul his car to an impound lot. Now, already, he doesn't have money. Already, it's a strain on him to go down there to L.A. for whatever reason that he had to go down. Let's say somebody, his family, had a medical problem. Or there's, you know, a relative that's sick or something.
Or he has a job interview down there to make a better life for himself.
That's a great example, sure. And so he's right on the edge of his budget just to get down there, and his car breaks down. Now what's he going to do? He's going to have to pay this guy for a tow bill that he didn't want, he didn't ask for, and an impound fee that he didn't want and didn't ask for on a car that's broke that he can't afford to fix, and he's all the way, what is that, like a 2-3 hour drive,
mm-hmm.
4 hour drive away from Barstow? Well, according to traffic, one side of LA to the other can be a 4 hour drive, but beside the point. Thank you, socialist highways.
It's a 2 hour drive to get to the edge of LA, and then it's a 3 hour drive to get to the center of LA.
Yeah. Where was I? I lost my... Okay, so there he is. His car dies, and he's stuck. Now, what can he do? Well, if he knows the right people, if he's connected, and he knows the right people... Oh, there's another phrase, connected. That doesn't mean the mafia.
Right.
That connected doesn't mean the mafia. And it doesn't even mean organized crime if you think crime as in things that don't hurt people.
Right. And it may not even mean that he is part of... a gang or right. anything like that.
Right. He's just a guy who works and is not rich. And he doesn't have a credit card, and he doesn't have AAA insurance, and he's just struggling to get along. But if he can get to a phone, and he can call someone who, let's say, is a member of a motorcycle club, and or the way the state looks at it, the motorcycle gang, because, oh, it's a gang.
Right.
But if he can get to, all right.
And again, this may not be some shady character. It may be a guy he works with.
Yeah.
It may be
somebody
you know.
Who knows somebody. But if he can get to a phone, and let's just say the Mongols can be told about this, or the Hell's Angels can be told about this, or in a different area of the country, you know, some other group, the Hessians can be told about it, or whoever. And they make a phone call, and instead of a wrecker showing up with a contract to the city, a wrecker shows up who's a friend. He's one of us. The wrecker shows up, gets the guy off the road, gets him to a location, fixes the car for him, puts him back on the road, possibly even puts a couple dollars in his pocket so he can have some lunch. Now, that's all done with a phone call. Yes, he has to pay it back. Usually, he has to pay it back by the next payday, which is generally a Friday. If he can't pay it back by Friday, then he has to pay the interest that is due on that. And generally, that's like a third, or according to who you're, you know, dealing with and what kind of relationship, what kind of long-term you might get. It might be as little as 10%, you know. It's according to what kind of relationship you have with the people that you're working with.
Mm-hmm.
But whoever it is, somebody has fronted that money for you because of your good reputation with them. Now, you're not, excuse me, you're not going to get that from a bank.
Mm-mm.
You're not going to go into a bank and say, hey, I need $200. They don't like to make $200 loans.
Right.
They like to make $5,000 loans. They like to put a second loan on your, second mortgage on your house, or they like to loan you, if you have a car that fits their description that they're comfortable with, they'll loan you money on that car.
Right. And it's a lot of times, if you are absolutely not in a position where you can pay that back, they will take the car.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, I mean, I had a situation in Pennsylvania where I was driving my car, and my car was kind of old and broken down, and it died on me. And I had to get it towed, and so a friend was basically like, look, I'll tow your car to my garage, and, you know, if you want me to fix it, you can pay me the money, or I can take the car off your hands, you know.
And that worked out the best for you, because
right.
that kept you from having to foot this giant repair bill.
Right, you know, and I didn't have to pay a repair bill, I didn't have to pay a disposal bill, I didn't have to pay a towing bill,
mm-hmm.
you know, none of that I had to deal with.
And in the hypothetical case of the guy from Barstow going to L.A., in that situation, when the guy finally got back to Barstow, he's doing business with a person he knows. And when Friday rolls around and it comes time to pay back the loan, or whenever payday is for that guy, the guy will come around and, you know, knock on your door, hey, you have that money, or he'll send a representative. Now, it's not like in the movies. They don't show up with thugs to beat you. If they beat you and you can't work, or if they kill you or they break your legs or whatever like that, they're not going to get their money back.
Right.
Well, that's not good business. That's stupid.
Right.
So it just doesn't exist. So they get there on Friday and the guy says, look, you know, I can't make a whole payment. I can't make a whole third. And he says, well, what can you do? What can we do? And, you know, maybe that means you're going to work for the guy Tuesday evening in his yard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's ways that these things can be worked out. So, you know, so you mow the guy's lawn on your off time from your job, or you agree to do something else. They demonize this stuff in Hollywood and make it sound like it's all horrible things. But the loan shark has a life, and he has things like a lawn,
mm-hmm.
and so
plumbing,
you know,
and
plumbing, and sure, and so maybe you know somebody, maybe you can't help him with the thing that he wants done. Let's say he has a plumbing issue. So instead, you call your cousin and you're like, hey, I owe this loan shark, $75, and if you could maybe help him out with this drain problem he's got. All right, now, these things are shifted around, and a true barter market takes place among these people.
Mm-hmm.
And these things are all worked out, and the vast majority of the time, no violence is ever needed. Now, I say that because sometimes situations turn violent, especially if you mix into this large amounts of alcohol or some types of drugs.
Right.
Back in the 70s, when I was employed in these types of markets, marijuana was often exchanged one way or the other for payment or in lieu of payment, or it was part of the loan, or it would be involved in one way or the other. And during the entire course of the years that I was involved in that kind of thing, I'm not aware ever of a situation involving a loan shark and a loan and marijuana ever turning violent. I know of a couple situations where people were using other kinds of drugs, like one particular that pops in my mind was meth, that the situation turned bad. And, well, I'm known of a couple like that where the situation turned bad. But it wasn't because of the loan shark situation, and it wasn't because of the loan itself. It was because of the idiot meth head.
Right.
And now the meth head, his meth use may have been subsidized somewhat by the black market. But if the black market in loans, if the loan sharking black market had not been there, he would have subsidized his meth habit some other way.
Right.
Probably by smashing somebody's window and stealing a radio or something.
Right.
I mean, the meth addict is going to do what he's going to do. The coke addict is going to do what he's going to do. And whatever laws exist or whatever, it doesn't matter. That guy is addicted, and has to feed his addiction. So, I don't know if Walter Block would be approve of my defense of the loan shark or not. But it's my bringing this up is an attempt to show that when you pass laws and you eliminate a whole section of people out of a market, first off, typically you eliminate the poorest people from the market.
Right.
You never see a law passed that eliminates the Bill Gates level rich people from a particular market.
Right.
There's no law saying, oh, you can't have a yacht. There would be no way that would be passed.
Right.
But to say that you have to go through certain qualifications in order to get, when you put restrictions on credit card companies to the point of where they have to behave in a certain way, then you eliminate all the lower end of the credit spectrum.
Right. And the thing is, like, when you regulate, markets will always regulate themselves to the point where the market has an equal footing.
Mm-hmm.
And if that market finds that equilibrium illegally or legally, it doesn't matter, it's gonna find that balance.
Right.
And so trying to regulate it with laws just makes it turn illegal.
Mm-hmm. Now, and by actually doing that, you do bring in, even though I said violence is generally not a part of real loan sharking, the fact that you have made it into an outlaw black market means that when things turn wrong, there's no one to turn to.
Yep.
The loanee or the loanor, how would you put that? The correct terminology ran out of my head. The guy loaning the money or the guy borrowing the money has no one to fall back on as far as laws are concerned.
Yep.
If things turn bad. So he's left either with a network of people who are already outlaws, or or violence himself.
Right.
So you create a situation where you force violence in where it wouldn't normally be in the market.
Yep.
I wanted to throw out one other thing. There's this is in reference to con artists. Con artists are considered really pretty low-life people. And we have a lot of them that are working both legally and illegally. And they are. There's a whole type of con artists that work purely legal.
Mm-hmm.
And then, for some reason, we have another group of con artists that we frown upon and we don't let them function legally. So they work underground. But instead of... There's such a variety of legal cons that are going on, and if you haven't seen it, just leave the TV on real late at night and stay awake. You drink some coffee and watch late night infomercials, or perhaps watch some televangelists, or just answer your phone when a telemarketer calls,
or you know, watch any politician talk.
Yeah, true. The state itself is a con. And, of course, the biggest con in the history of the world is the Social Security Administration. It's a Ponzi scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been clearly, I don't even have to put out the evidence for that. It's been clearly shown as a Ponzi scheme. There are legal cons and there are illegal cons. But here's the thing about a successful con. The word con is actually confidence. So it's a confidence scheme. That's what a con is. A confidence scheme is where one person, the player or the con man or the confidence man, or grifter, he's also called, he contacts the mark. Now, the mark is the person who is ultimately we consider the victim.
Right.
The victim, the mark, has to have a flaw for this to work correctly. In almost all cons, the victim, the mark, has to want something for nothing, or he has to want his own greed. The con only works on his own greed.
Right.
So, for instance, let's take Social Security. The only way Social Security can be sold to the public is if they think they're going to get more mm-hmm. than what they would otherwise. They want something they didn't work for.
Right.
Now, that's the only way that Social Security was sold on the American public. It was handed to a public, that a middle-aged public working in jobs. They were told they would get a free retirement because they're only going to work a few years and retire. And then they're going to get paid the whole rest of their life.
Right.
Now, this con was inflicted upon one generation. And now here we are, 2-3 generations later, and we're saddled with the end of the con,
right?
For paying for the con. So in essence, our grandparents, in some cases great grandparents, bit the con, and now we have to pay. And so what are our options? Well, we can buy back into the con and dump it off to our grandchildren, if we're that kind of a person to do that.
Right.
But that's how a con works.
And if it doesn't all collapse before then.
Yeah. But that's how a con works. You have to, first you gain the confidence of the mark, and then you play on the mark's greed, hoping to get something for nothing. And then you set up the mark, you set up the mark, but you set up the sting itself, and then you take the guy's money, and that's how it works. So
the only difference there with the Social Security Administration is that it was a little hard for the federal government to, cut and run after they had made their money.
Yeah. Well, no, they did in a way. They just died. They died before they could be prosecuted.
True.
All of the original con artists are dead, and all the original marks are dead. And here we are, these generations. Now we've got new con artists trying to convince us to keep the con going. And then it's up to us. Are we going to con? Are we going to allow ourselves to be the mark and push this off to another generation? There's an old phrase that goes, you can't cheat an honest man. Now, that's used in the con industry among grifters. They say
that's
this.
That's not true. Honest men are the easiest people to cheat ever.
You, in order to cheat an honest man, you have to play on his naivety.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to convince him that he's helping someone.
You know how hard it is to con a con artist? That's hard.
Exactly.
Conning an honest person is easy. It's the only way you can con someone.
Well, no, you can con a greedy person who's naive.
True.
As a matter of fact, that's, you know, very often the case. But the honest person, the only way you can con the honest person is through their naivety, to make them think they're helping someone else.
Mm-hmm.
A classic is the violin con. Or do you know the violin con?
I don't know the violin.
The way the violin con works, and it can be any object. A violin is just something somebody in the 1800s used or whatever. But
right.
So I'll use violin because that's the classic con. A person walks into a restaurant, let's say, and says, "Hey, I just found this violin sitting on the ground outside the door. Does it belong to somebody?" And the owner of the restaurant, or the keeper, or who, you know, the manager on duty or whatever,
right,
says, "I've never seen it before in my life." They ask around the restaurant. Nobody in the restaurant has seen the violin. So the finder of the violin, in this case, the finder is the con,
right,
the con artist, and the restaurant owner is the mark. So the con artist says, do you want to hold on to it in case the owner shows up? Now, about this time, the phone rings, and some employee of the restaurant or the owner answers the phone, and now you have the third man, who is often called a shrill, or there's several other names, but would you say the shrill? So the phone rings, and the shrill calls and says, "Hey, I was just down at your restaurant and got some quick things. I can't find my violin. It's an extremely expensive violin. It's worth almost $10,000. Have you seen my violin?" And the restaurant owner, "What a coincidence. Guy just found your violin." And so the shrill reiterates, "It's a $10,000 violin. Please hold on to it for me. I'm going to be down there in half an hour to pick it up.
Right.
It's extremely important. I'm a violin." And you can elaborate the story. I'm, you know, with the Philharmonic or whatever. And the restaurant owner, out of kindness, wants to help this man with his violin. And so the violin guy says, "Look, I'll give you $200 if you keep that violin safe for me for a half an hour till I get down there. I'll give you a $200 reward." And the shop owner says, "Oh, you don't have to do that." And the violin owner says, no, you please." The shrill says, "No, please. I would feel better if I give you $200 reward. That way I know you'll keep it safe for me and you'll be rewarded for helping me because this is so important."
Right.
So the restaurant owner says, okay, half an hour. The shrill hangs up. The con man is standing in front of the restaurant owner and says, "Look, I can't wait a half an hour. I got to go right now. I've got an important job interview I have to be at in 5 minutes. And the restaurant owner, being honest, says, "Yeah, but what about the $200 reward?" And the guy goes, "Well, how about if I split it with you? You take 100 and I take 100. And the restaurant owner's like, "Yeah, well, that's fair." So the restaurant owner pulls $100 out of the till, hands the cash register, hands the con artist $100. Con artist hands him the violin. The violin was picked up down the street at a hawk shop for maybe $10.
Right.
Because it's a piece of garbage violin.
There's no violin at all and it's an empty case.
Exactly. The con man walks out with $100. Half an hour goes by, nobody shows up for the violin. At some point, assuming it's an empty case, the restaurant owner opens the case, realizes he's been conned. There's no way to turn this in. There's no way to catch these guys. He's got a vague description at best of one of the guys. But you know what? He probably didn't really pay attention to the guy because he was convinced the whole time that he was helping people.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't necessarily do it out of greed, but he did it because he wanted to help somebody.
Right.
Now, the way a greed confidence game goes is similar to what you might see on TV late at night. You can buy property and make a fortune off of it with no money down. And these offers just seem too good to be true.
Mm-hmm.
You can just invest the smallest amount, get this series of lectures and this book, and you'll know how to make a fortune in property. Or any of the other dozens of these things.
On the internet.
Yeah, yeah. You make money on the internet. Or they'll call you on the phone. We get called regularly. We own property in Arkansas. And they will constantly, every time the property tax is renewed, that kicks in the public notice that the property tax has been paid. And it goes on to public lists. And we get called by a con artist. And the con goes like this. Oh, hey, you are the owner of that property in Arkansas? Yes, I am. Would you like to list it for sale with us? We have a buyer for you. They don't have a buyer.
Yeah.
All they want to do is charge us a fee to put it on their listing. But nobody sees their listing because they don't really sell any property. It's just a way to charge us a fee. Now, they will try to tell you that they can get way more money for your property than what you think it's worth. Why would you keep paying taxes on that property that you don't even go see? And so now they're playing up on your greed.
Mm-hmm.
These scams, these cons, are entirely legal.
Yep.
And how is that different from the guy with the violin? A con is a con.
Yep.
Whether it's on TV telling you that they're going to make a fortune for you, or whether it's calling you on the phone, or whether it's leaving you a fake violin.
Or, you know, you go to the absolute most legal cons of all, where they'll go, okay, here's what you do. You buy our product, and then you can sell it, and you'll be a businessman.
Yeah, just get five friends to buy this product from you.
Yeah.
Or get five friends to join and sell also, and you'll get money from each one of them, and then we'll pay you a check too.
Yeah.
That's a modified pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
Oh, no. We'll call it multi-level marketing.
Yeah, you can't call it a pyramid scheme.
It's perfectly legal, and yet it's a con.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter, you know, on what level this con takes place, whether it's the Social Security Administration, or whether it's late-night TV, or whether it's a guy with a violin, it's still a con.
Yep.
And whether the numbers racket is run by a guy who's randomly taking numbers out of the newspaper, or if it's run by the state with little floaty balls that bounce around, and the lady that says, 42, 26. What is it? How is it different?
Yeah.
Morally speaking, a numbers racket is a numbers racket, no matter who runs it. And morally speaking, a con is a con, no matter who runs it.
Yep.
So how is it that if we just tape state onto something, suddenly now it's moral?
Yep.
So it's illegal if I have five friends come over and we play some poker. That's illegal. I could be arrested for that. And as a matter of fact, there was a big bust not too long ago right locally to us. They hit the newspapers, high stakes gambling. And you find out that it was like, I think it was $20 buy-in or something like that for a Texas Hold'em game. And they portrayed it as a high-level gambling. And it was some guys in a basement. But yet, you can drive a couple hours from here and get on a boat that's fake floating on the Ohio River.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, because it's on a boat and the state allows it, you can gamble.
Yeah.
Or you can go right one town over from us, 30 miles away, and you can bet on horses.
Yep.
Now, if it's okay to bet on the horses there, why can't 10 people sit in my living room, watch the Kentucky Derby, and bet on it?
Yeah.
That's stupid.
Yeah.
Why is it that the state has to authorize morality?
Yep.
How is it that the state can tell us what's moral and what's not?
Well, it's just like, you know, the state has two plants, right? And both of these plants are herbal remedies that people dry, chop up, and smoke. One of them, the federal government subsidizes the growth of it.
And we know it kills people.
And we know it kills people. The other one, the federal government will arrest, put into a cage, and possibly murder you if you're found with it.
It's goofy. It's absolutely goofy, and it's goofy for us to tolerate it.
Yeah.
And it's goofy for us to ask the state to change its rules to give us permission to gamble in our own living room, right, or grow a particular plant, or loan money to somebody under certain circumstances or whatever. It's silly that we tolerate the state telling us these things. You got anything else?
Oh, no. I think we've wasted enough time.
Yeah, I think we went over time again. I probably shouldn't have taken us off on that tangent. Well, anyway, thank you for listening. This is Ben and
Kai.
And Kai from BadQuaker.com. Be sure and check with us at BadQuaker.com for more podcasts and updates. And we really appreciate you listening. Thanks a lot.